Hello and welcome to the 7th episode in the ONFIF focus series on globalization. Today we discuss international treaties and global governance as a means of tackling global warming. My name is Anton Varga, and today I am joined by Simon Buckle, Head of the Climate Change, Biodiversity and Water Division at the OECD. Thank you for joining us today, Simon.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Now, climate change presents us with one of the world's biggest challenges, and in order to be tackled effectively, it requires an international response. Therefore, transnational treaties and global governance is vital to steer private investment in a green direction. Simon, you just come back from the COP23 climate conference in Bonn, hosted by the United Nations Convention on Climate Change, where national governments, as well as the private and non-profit sectors, are meeting to discuss the implementation of the Paris Agreement. I would like to ask you more about those discussions and what the key conference takeaways were shortly. But let's first put this into context. The most far-reaching international agreement dealing with greenhouse gas emissions is, of course, the Paris Climate Agreement, which was agreed in December 2015. In the agreement, each national government determines and reports its own contribution to tackling climate change, and there is no mechanism to force a country to set specific targets to reduce emissions. So, Simon, how can the Paris Agreement increase the scope and effectiveness of climate change action to ensure the agreement's goals are met?
Thanks, Anton. Yeah, an important question. So the Paris Agreement, historic agreement, there's no question that it was a success after many years of hard work following the failures at Copenhagen in 2009. But it's a hybrid agreement. That means that governments have agreed on an overarching goal, a well below 2 degrees temperature target for the mitigation goal. But in terms of implementation, it relies on contributions, so-called nationally determined contributions from countries. So the vast majority of countries have now offered or submitted their nationally determined contributions, NDCs, and these outline their plans for their emissions after 2020. And for some countries, these will increase still because they're developing countries still growing. For many countries, there'll be absolute reductions in emissions, and for some, there'll be reductions in the intensity of emissions. That is, the amount of emissions for every unit of GDP will be declining according to a commitment they've given in the NDC. But in aggregate, the level of ambition for these emissions is too low. So we're nowhere near on a cost-effective path to this well below 2-degree target. We're more on the track for something the upper end of 2 degrees or maybe 3 degrees centigrade temperature change by the end of the century. Now, it's not as though the architects of the Paris Agreement was stupid. They realized that there was this incentive, if you like, to look at everything from a national perspective, the temptation to slightly free ride, that's to take advantage of the emissions reductions that others are making, not to make as many yourself. All these things are well known and they're part of the climate negotiation history. So what they did in the Paris Agreement was to put in place a transparency and review mechanism, which over time is meant to enable countries to gain confidence in what other countries are doing, to get greater convergence in policies, and eventually greater ambition in the reductions. So that's the aim, that over time you can build this transparency and review mechanism to something that has teeth, that really exposes what countries are doing and encourages them to go further because they know that other countries are doing the same. That said, there are still challenges and problems with that. The way that the agreement is designed means that the NDCs, the nationally determined contributions, imply very different carbon prices in different countries. So in some countries where absolute emissions reductions might be quite challenging and there might not be very many low-cost options for reducing emissions, the carbon price might have to be quite significant. In other countries where the emissions targets are less challenging, perhaps where there are low-cost options for emissions reduction, the cost of carbon might be quite low. And you could actually get a lot more effectiveness and economic efficiency by having a system where prices were aligned in some way, either by gradually coordinating and moving carbon prices together over time. Maybe there would never be a single global price, but at least getting convergent, or through the linking on a regional basis maybe of some trading schemes. And we're seeing that happen a little bit in North America at the moment, actually at a subnational level. So there are well-known difficulties in getting effective global action. The Paris Agreement gives us a mechanism that should allow us to do this, but the time is short in which we have to reduce the emissions to meet the goal. So urgency and ambition are the order of the day.
This leads on well to my next question, which is that many of the Paris participant nations have just this week gathered in Bonn for the COP23 climate conference. What was the feeling amongst the delegates about the progress in implementing the Paris Agreement?
So it's a strange atmosphere. The first week of Conference of the Party is often quite unreal in some ways. Negotiators are getting together after some time. They're coming back to the issues. They're trying to stake out positions for a second week in which hopefully the deals that have to be done will reach a conclusion. The key issues perhaps for this Conference of the Parties, for this COP, are one, agreeing on what happens in the so-called facilitative dialogue in 2018. This is a process that's meant to take stock of collective progress and inform the development of future NDCs. So it's a chance to say, we're not doing so well, we need to accelerate action, hopefully. And how this process unfolds, what information it gets, and what outcomes and outputs there are from that process has not yet been agreed. And this is the time now that has to happen at COP23. And the second key thing where further progress is needed is on the transparency and review mechanism itself, the real details of that. How is it going to be done in different areas, reflecting the diversity of countries, but also reflecting that we now have a single agreement that covers both developing and developing countries. But it needs to also reflect and give flexibility to countries because there are different circumstances and different capabilities to provide information on some of these things. There are also some commitment that apply only to developed countries. The climate finance commitment is one of those, for example. So these are quite technical issues, but they have a political dimension that means that they take a while to resolve. And so I think in this first few days, there's been some progress in some areas that people have mentioned to me they thought was surprising and positive. And then in other areas, people have been perhaps repeating some of the old arguments, the old political differences that people thought were settled before Paris. And I expect next week we'll see that move on. It'll get more to the agreeing what needs to be done in 2018 and getting some sort of political deal on those issues. So it's a technical COP, it's an important COP, but there isn't a single crunch period or crunch issue as there was in Paris in COP21. So I expect that the negotiators will find a way through that allows the implementation of Paris to proceed in a smooth way. Certainly that's the hope.
So what are the next steps for national governments and international bodies to take in order to work towards the goals of the agreement?
So governments have already made some commitments about what they're going to do for their emissions up to 2020. And as I said, they've also made statements about what they're going to do with their emissions after 2020 in these NDCs. And I think basically now it's time to implement that. It's time to get on with these emissions reductions and to the extent possible to scale up the pace of action and the extent of action. And countries, I think, have a temptation to just look at this agreement through their national perspective, a narrow national perspective, and think what's in their interests if they just look at what are the narrow national benefits of action and the national costs of action on a marginal basis. And you can't tackle a global challenge like climate change like that. You're never going to get sufficient action to stave off the major risks that we face, certainly in the second half of this century, in terms of extreme weather, in terms of potential thresholds in the climate system itself, but also thresholds in some of our socioeconomic systems that could be triggered by climate extremes and so on. So countries have to really look at these risks. They need to confront, if you like, this short-term self-interest with the urgency and severity of the challenge of getting to something like a below the 2-degree target. What that means is that they need to address this shortfall in the aggregate level of emissions reductions. And if you think about purely national incentives for doing something about that, they are important. And I don't think countries are perhaps always giving them sufficient weight. Countries are linked through intricate trade and global value chains. So climate damages in other parts of the world can affect a third country, even if that country itself doesn't suffer from those direct climate damages. So if you think in terms of the floods in Thailand in 2012, that disrupted the global value chains, had knock-on effects on other countries. Given that global emissions are what drives climate change, not emissions in any one country, that means every country has an interest in limiting the risks. So that's one reason for taking more action. The fact that the climate can throw up nasty surprises in terms of extreme weather is another reason why countries need to really take a very precautionary approach to their emissions. They need to take more seriously the fact that damages could be worse than maybe they're anticipating at the moment. We've had some warming, quite a bit of warming, 0.8 degrees centigrade relative to pre-industrial, but impacts are expected to be non-linear as this temperature increases. So there's worse to come, we think. How bad? Yes, that's a matter for some uncertainty, but you would want to take a precautionary approach to taking the climate system out of the parameters it's been in for the last 800,000 years. And that's what we're talking about now. We are dramatically changing the climate system. So there's a precautionary motive for action. And also you need to think in terms of the local short-term benefit of action that also give you long-term climate benefits. Think of better air quality, reducing air pollution, improving health, reducing traffic congestion from great use of public transport or from reducing the extent of coal generation or coal use in industry. These are all things that have immediate benefit for societies, and they can have huge impact on health, well-being and the economy, and they can get those benefits now. So that's one action that countries can actually take that aligns the short-term and the long-term incentives, if you like, very well. And some countries are being very ambitious. The Swedish government wants to make its domestic vehicle fleet independent of fossil fuels by 2030. The UK is expanding its offshore wind capacity dramatically. Even in developing countries, things are happening. India invited competitive bids from companies to supply renewable energy, and they found that they had bids at 3.8 cents a kilowatt hour, far below the cost of fossil alternatives from solar. So this sort of technology is also driving ambition and action. There's an element of competition. Countries might want to position themselves in these new value chains of the future as well. And that's a positive dynamic that should encourage action. So it's not all negative.
Thank you, Sam, and that's very interesting. Now I'd like to turn to the issue of private investment. Over $1 trillion has been invested in solutions to deal with climate change, such as renewables and energy efficiency. However, in order to meet the goals set in the Paris Agreement, much more will need to be invested. Arguably, this will require government reforms and innovative business models to create new markets in order to attract the necessary investment. Was this discussed this week at COP23? And specifically, were any plans laid out to engage further with the private sector to attract more investment?
So there were lots of discussions and side events around finance and mobilizing finance, and it was notable that all the big development banks and regional development banks were involved in either their own events or speaking at other people's events. So there's a lot of interest and activity in that space. In terms of the formal negotiations, most of the focus at this stage was on how do you define climate finance? That's one of the very contentious issues in the negotiations at the moment. And it's important because it determines, if you like, the scale and nature of the resources that might flow to developing countries from action by developed countries in mobilizing both public and associated private climate finance. So at this stage, I think there wasn't a huge amount. I think there's much more potential to engage with the private sector. For example, at President Macron's summit and the associated side events in December, where there really is going to be a focus on how you can accelerate action and do that outside, if you like, of just the purely government sector. Coming back to the trillions that need to be mobilized, absolutely. But that can't all be public money. There isn't really the scope for public finances to fund all the investments that are needed in every country. Clearly, some countries are in better fiscal positions than others. But in all countries, they will need to mobilize private finance to make these investments. So that means that we need good policies in place, core climate policies. You need an incentive, a carbon price there to make some of these projects more attractive and profitable in terms of a risk return for private investors. You also need to think about the enabling environments for these investments. You need good governance, competition laws, stability of policy so that there aren't changes when governments change and you get retroactive changes in policies. All these things can upset investors and inhibit their willingness to invest in the transition. So there's a range of things that really need to be done, but there's no shortage of money. In the sense, there's plenty of money in the institutional investors. They're looking for these sorts of stable returns that infrastructure investments can give them. If it's clean, if it's resilient to climate change, that infrastructure should give us the returns that are needed to fund the pensions of the future. And of course, insurance companies are seeing climate change on both sides of their balance sheets, both in terms of the potential impacts they're insuring, but also in terms of their assets. They've got to invest in assets that are not going to lose their value in a world that's moving towards a low emission future. So a lot of pension companies, insurance companies, beginning to think about how they decarbonize their portfolios. Clearly, you can't do that all at once in one go. But over time, that's got to happen. Of course, the companies themselves in which these investments are made are going to have to disclose their climate risks now. We have increasing acceptance that that's an important part of corporate behavior. We've got the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure that's just made its recommendations public in the last few months. And there's a big initiative in the EU also to look at sustainable finance. So there's increasing pressure for companies to come clean on what their strategy is for climate change, what risks they are facing and how they're dealing with those. And that will help to generate change as well in some of the financial markets and the behavior of the private sector.
What kind of projects, investments, and financial instruments can be used to achieve meeting the goals set in the Paris Agreement?
So in terms of the Paris Agreement, there's one goal that we should remember, which is making financial flows consistent with low emissions, climate resilient development pathways. So it's not just low emissions, but it's also resilient. And financial flows cover the whole range of things that we have now. We're not inventing completely new infrastructure. We're investing in things that we would need to invest in anyway. It's ports, it's roads, it's rail, it's water, sanitation. We're going to see some revolutions, I think, too, in areas such as IT being deployed to enhance the responsiveness, effectiveness, and efficiency of grids. So we'll have smart grids where we have the demand side integrated much more with the supply side. So big investments in the energy demand side, which perhaps are new and different from what's gone before. But a lot of the projects will be power projects, but they'll be clean technologies increasingly. Hopefully, we'll also see more political commitment and private and public money going into large-scale demonstration of carbon capture and storage plants. That's, I think, a key technology for achieving the Paris goals and an underappreciated one by many people. Very many fossil intensive economies are not going to find this transition very easy, and carbon capture and storage could be a way of enabling them to make this jump from a really fossil intensive present to something that in future is going to be low emissions. They might still then be able to use and sell fossil fuels, but the emissions can't be allowed to go into the atmosphere. Or if they are, they've got to be offset in some way by technologies that take CO2 from the atmosphere elsewhere. There are technologies we have now that are well developed. Solar, wind, storage and batteries are increasingly improving. But there's some solutions we don't yet have, and we're going to need both demonstration projects, but also fundamental R&D and innovation to tackle some of those. The financial instruments that you might use, I think for projects where there are new risks, there's going to need to be some way to make the projects attractive to these institutional investors and to commercial banks who maybe won't be in a position to take on all of the risks immediately. But as technologies get more established, as we're seeing now with solar and wind, the rationale to use public money will diminish. So I think in developing economies where the conditions are more challenging for investment, you're going to see a lot of public money going through development banks, multilateral development banks, which is used to bring in the private sector by reducing the risks for them, whether that's through equity tranches or whether it's through guarantees in some form. But basically, strategic use of public money to mobilize the private money to help this transition happen is going to be the name of the game.
Thank you, Simon. So how can technological innovation play a role in achieving both environmental sustainability and economic growth at the same time?
So innovation is fundamental, and I'd say it's not just technological. You need innovation in business models as well as innovations in technologies. So if we think in terms of public transport, if we think in terms of shared vehicle models, technology is going to make those things much more attractive. You can have ways to plan your route through mobile technology now, and if you can join up the different transport providers with the local authority boundaries, which is a key challenge in some places, you're going to be able to do a lot to take private vehicles off the road and drive people onto public transport. But you need to have integrated solutions that allow people to think how they get from A to B without having to wait for an hour at an intermediate point because the bus isn't synchronized with the train or whatever. Then you've got models of vehicle sharing where you don't need to own a new expensive EV vehicle, but maybe you're a member of a sharing club or you can rent it. And so you're taking the capital cost away from the consumer and they're just buying the service. And that makes the transition more affordable there. So those sorts of innovations will help the transition go forward, and we're seeing them being rolled out as we speak. Some more fundamental innovation is still needed in terms of how do we make, as I said, these technologies that pull CO2 from the atmosphere viable, because the risk is we're going to emit too much over the next few decades, and we'll need to claw that back at some point in the future to stop temperatures rising above 2 degrees. So there's some really advanced technologies there that are pipe dreams, and then there's some more that are nearer to market, but they've got big question marks around them as well in terms of their sustainability. So think of something called BECCS, biomass enhanced CCS, where you burn biomass in a power station, you regrow it on the land somewhere else, draw CO2 from the ground, and the CO2 that you burn in your power station, you sequester underground. So it's like normal CCS, but you're actually drawing down CO2 from the atmosphere by burning some crop. Now, that's costly. I mean, it reduces the efficiency of the power generation as well as having the cost of the CCS. But it may be something that we need. And all the modeling by energy experts suggests that these sorts of technologies are going to be important. And even if individually they're expensive, as part of the energy system, they make sense because they allow you to do things with other parts that you couldn't do otherwise. And other innovations clearly large-scale energy storage, all the radical changes that we expect in the energy demand side, the Internet of Things, driving your home appliances, all these things are going to be fundamental as well to making this transition in an affordable, effective way.
Well, thank you very much, Simon, for an informative and insightful discussion. It's been great hearing your thoughts on COP23 Climate Conference, the progress made so far in implementation of the Paris Agreement, the role of private investment, as well as technological innovation. Next week's episode on shifting demographic flows will be live on the OnFifth channel on Tuesday, so you can download it once it has been broadcast or subscribe to our channel. If you've enjoyed the programme, then please do leave us a review.